Okie dokie. I'd like to dedicate this shir for a refuah shlema for Tzivia Bas Yehudis and Chaya Simcha Bas Janet Jamila, who both need a refuah shlema. May this be a source of merit for them. Okay, we were on page 207. We are in section 3, which is the soul, inspiration and prophecy. And we're finishing off the theurgy section before we talk about prophecy. And theurgy, of course, is making things that are supernatural happen through ritualistic behaviour. That's the definition of theurgy. You do a ritual to make something happen. And we talked about this at great, great length. I know there's new people who are going, I don't know what you're talking about. What are you talking about? I can't roll back because it'll be unfair for the people who were here that did do it. And we've got to keep moving on. But if there's any questions, policy is put your hand up as a go, and I'll try to answer as we go. But this is in the middle of a section before we...
Is that like the stuff for the Ein Hara, the Kabbalistic things that people do? Because in Israel, there are all these women who...
who pour lead. These...
Yes, yeah.
Yes, no, it isn't.
Okay, fine, carry on. No.
Okay, but it's good you got the feel of it, of just like stopping me whenever you like, which is fine. Okay, I'm going to start at point 8. We already, I think, started the first few sentences, and there, if you've got pens or pencils or highlighters with you, we're going to need to do some highlighting if you haven't already highlighted, okay? Obviously, for those people who are borrowing books, please don't make any marks in them, because some people do that. Okay, point 8. Include, so Andy, you okay? We're on page 207. 207, point 8. Included in God's decree that the world contained both good and evil, he also decreed that evil would be found throughout creation at every degree and at every level possible. Going back to the sheet, which we know and love now, which is our four world sheet. Okay, for those that have got that previously, I've got maybe a couple of spare copies to give to people. Do I have any couple of spare copies? Yeah, let's give them out. One each. And this is my last copy. This is a Somin HaShemayim that I've got just the right amount of copies. This four world thing, the encoding for evil has to go all the way to the top of the Kofas. It has to go all the way to the top of world 3. However, there is no evil in the top world, world 4. Okay? God himself is not evil. Evil is merely an absence of God. But God had to create a concept of evil in order for us to overcome it. That means that has to be encoded right at the top. Okay? That's there to flesh out that first half of the sentence, i.e. throughout creation at every degree and every level possible. That means it's got to be encoded in the Koichos, in the primordial forces, which is the framework and scaffolding of creation. And highlight. The task was given to man to combat evil. This is a highlight point. The task was given to man to combat evil. All the way to the end of this indent, actually. The task was given to man to combat evil and prevent it from ruling and acting in any way, at any level, until in its every aspect would be completely removed from creation. Basically, God has given man the job of soaking up evil and avoiding it. You won't be able to destroy evil from the physical universe because Kodesh Baruch Hu has encoded it into the physical universe. It is there, so we have to avoid it. But any time that we interact with it, our job is to overcome it and thereby earn reward. I know for the new people, you're thinking, oh my gosh, what are you talking about? I know, but we've done it. No, but I am sorry, I feel so bad. I just want to go over the whole thing again, but it's not fair. No evil or... Okay, that's the end of the highlight bit. No evil or imperfection can possibly be found in God himself. Now, we discussed that. That's section 1, chapter 1, point 2. That's right at the very beginning of the book, right? It is only in created things that imperfection and evil can exist. Can anyone define that? Why can we not find any imperfection? Sorry. Why can we not find any evil or imperfection in God himself? He says that at the beginning of the line. Can anyone justify that for me? Any of the old timers?
He's perfect.
He's perfect. How do you define perfection?
Absence of faults and flaws and imperfection.
Right, a complete absence of any deficiency. So God himself cannot be evil. He can't have evil in him. Because whatever the evil would be a deficiency or some kind of absence of good. if he needed to improve at spelling, that would be considered evil, because that's distance from perfection. God can't improve at spelling. Yeah? It is only in created things that imperfection and evil can exist. The fact they've been created, by the way, is in and of itself an imperfection. You can't be perfect and be dependent upon something else. Yeah? The design was thus that there be created levels that are good for God's creatures. Their opposite was also created, and this is the essence of evil. It would therefore be possible for evil to exist, so that through his efforts man would be able to remove it from his own essence, as well as from creation in general. Obviously what he's talking about here is he's introducing us to the concept of evil and the fact that man has access to it. Okay, we all have access to evil, either through deeds or through items or actions, which would be wrong. The fact that we've got access to it means we can manipulate it, and the fact that we can manipulate it means we could bend it to our will either physically or supernaturally, if you're going to be talking from a Kishuv perspective, which is why he's introducing this topic here, because what we're going to be talking about now is utilizing negative things in order to gain power from them. So he's got to like kind of open up the door for us to be able to understand that that's even possible at all. Absolutely, Clive.
Early on, we defined evil as distance from God.
That's right.
Therefore, it's not of itself an essence, and not of an event or an identity, but simply a lack of or distance from God.
That's the archetypal definition of evil is distance from God.
But now he's suggesting effectively that evil in itself is an essence, it is an identity, it has an identity.
Well, he had to make up the idea. Before creation was there, there was no such thing as evil, there was just him. So he had to make up the idea of something called distance from me, distance from him. He had to do that. That encoding of that concept of there being something far from him is the very beginning of the concept of evil. And that has to be encoded right at the top of the primordial forces, which is the scaffolding of all creation. He also had to create things, which physical things, which would in and of themselves be negative, things that would draw you away from him. He had to make that. Indeed, in Gun Eden, in the Garden of Eden, what was the evil in Gun Eden?
Snake.
Nope, snake was not evil.
Vietnam.
Nope.
Temptation.
Nope. Temptation is a good thing. Okay, what was the good in Gun Eden? Come on, guys. You guys are the experts, right? You're the term haters. What was the good in Gun Eden? No, it wasn't. Nothing was almost nothing was good.
It was all parav.
It was all parav. Almost everything in Gun Eden was parav.
Apart from the temptation given to Eve.
Temptation is not good or bad.
Man.
You don't like men.
Man's good.
is man good? I don't know. It depends if you meet any of them.
God,
man certainly wasn't good. Man definitely wasn't good. If he was good, the whole thing would be unbalanced, and the whole thing would be ridiculous.
Created.
No, he wasn't.
He was created with good and
no, he wasn't. Nature. No. He was totally
powerful.
No, this goes back like 10-15 Shurim. Sorry. I know. I'd like to
go.
Through.
I was just quoting bits of Tanya. That's all. Where we have a godly
It's incorrect. What we're saying. What you're saying.
I put on the shamas were good essentially.
I can't go into it now.
Okay, fine. All right.
In Gan Eden, good and evil were separate entities, easily identifiable.
Yes.
And after the sin,
what were those identifiable good and evil bits, Clive?
Substance abuse. The only evil was don't eat of that fruit because it will cause you to die.
I just undid it. Let's start that again. Sorry, you just got it backwards. Let's start again. So you said.
So in Gan Eden, good and evil were totally separate.
What were they?
What were they?
Yeah.
Good was avoiding eating.
Good was the presence of the closeness to God. And evil,
but actually, what physically was the good? If I was walking down the street and I met Adam. Hello, Adam. Hello, Mitch. Where's the good round here? He'd go, there it is. And I go, oh, wow, that's so cool. What would it be? The tree of knowledge was not good. It was not bad.
There's nothing.
Was anything
Oh, you're meant to be the good guys. Come on. The wind. The wind.
We're the good.
All right, okay, I can see we need some revision here.
He gave Adam a test. The test
is not good.
The test is, I want you to live and live forever and be part of me that I can give up my good to you. And part of that is I've got one test.
Oh, for goodness sake, you're trying to make design not good and bad. I'm not asking for design. All right, I'm going to give it to you. Because clearly we need some revision. Here we go. We've had a week off. This always happens. We get rusty after a break. It's okay. We're going to get back into it. It's okay. Okay, I'll let this one slide. The good was the Lushan tithe of the directive. The only good that existed in Gun Eden was the statement, don't eat of this. That's all we had was at Sivawi. Everything else was Parv. The only evil in Gun Eden was the lie of the snake. That was Lushan Hara. That's all there was. The snake was merely cunning. The snake misrepresented God, lied about God, and cheated man's consciousness, saying that God's scared of you. He doesn't want you to eat of this because he's scared what will happen to your consciousness and you may threaten him. No, you've got it backwards. You said what you said. You said that was actually good. Again, let's get this very, very clear. The physical thing that was good in the Garden of Eden was God's directive saying, don't eat it. That was the good bit. The bad bit was the snake saying, do eat it. That's it. Now.
Are those physical? How can a
statement is a physical thing, a directive, it's a law. It's a new mitzvah. A new mitzvah and a new aveira. You're right, it's quite a theory in the fact that it's, you know, don't park on a double yellow line. Who's to say? You park your paint over there, some guy comes along with a can of paint and says, don't park there. Is that a thing? Yeah, I don't know.
It's a physical manifestation.
It's a physical manifestation, the fact that I've got a directive.
Can't touch it, though.
You can't, sure you can touch it.
Because he didn't hear it, did he?
Oh, I'm sorry, you're talking about the other tree. Yeah, you can't, no. That's right, you can't, that's right. In the Garden of Eden, the actual good and evil that was present were directives.
Which are not physical things.
They're not like a pig. That's right, it's not like a pink oink oink kind of farm animal. That's right, you can't pick it up.
But they're like commandments.
Mm. But the mitzvah has a physical...
It did! The physical thing that it sat on was a tree.
Right, okay.
But the tree was not good or evil.
Yeah.
A piece of meat is not good or evil.
Sure.
If it's kosher, there's nothing good. The kosher is, are you going to eat it in a kosher way or are you going to eat it in a non-kosher way? There's nothing. Most things are parav. Which means that he had to encode the ability to transgress his will. He had to put that in. That's the evil already in it. He had to make that system present.
That means therefore for every piece of good in the world, an opposite, and which is by effect, therefore, by his definition, is evil.
Sorry, say that again.
Yeah.
But every statement of good or whatever or good within the world, God had to create the opposite, which is by definition, therefore, evil. Therefore, don't eat pork. Therefore, by definition, eating pork has to be of its own. And the essence.
There are certain things where the mirror opposite is evil. But there are certain things where the lack of compliance is not evil, it's a lack of good.
And therefore it distances you from God.
It doesn't distance you from God, it just doesn't bring you closer. You've got to be really accurate about this. Okay, let's talk about the question you're asking is, are they always equal and opposites?
Yeah.
That's always true with negative mitzvahs. Don't eat pork. If you eat pork, then it will have a negative effect on you. Dwell in a sukkah is a positive mitzvah. If you don't dwell in a sukkah, you don't get the benefit. So basically, what you've lost out on are the benefits, but you haven't polluted the system per se. You've taken yourself out of the loop of the benefit. So there's no equal and opposite about not dwelling in a sukkah. all you can do is not gain. It's like, don't buy the winning lottery ticket. It's like, buy the winning lottery ticket. So I go to my shop and I go, no, I couldn't be bothered. You don't get a punishment for not buying the winning lottery ticket, apart from the fact that now you don't win the lottery.
So the same way in the Garden of Eden, don't eat the apple.
Ah, oh, now that he gave them a lois, I say, he gave them a negative precept. So there is an evil opposite.
And that's what the snake would
have done. That's it. That's it. If you abuse that substance, if you become a drug taker and you want to eat that substance, it will negatively affect you. That negativity is what we call evil. It's a distance from clarity. I talked about the fact about if someone tried to sell you drugs and you'd be very interesting, and then they said, but if you take it, you'll never, ever come back to consciousness. Almost nobody would do it. And that proves that this level of consciousness is higher than whatever trip you would get by taking acid or cocaine or anything like that. Because if you really knew you'd never come back, you'd never do it. You're willing to take a little journey, but you don't want that be forever. Because really we know that where we are is in a better place. Adrian, you had your hand up.
I know this is COT, but very, very shortly.
COT stands for completely off topic and results in a bell ring. It allows me either to totally ignore the question or to answer it, but on a divergent tangent that you can follow.
Okay.
That's what COT means.
Is there a Gemara dealing with which comes first? Was the world created because evil came first and God had to have a positive aspect to go good to go with it and created the world or the universe?
COT. I'm screaming COT.
But the
way that you're questioning is not clear. I'd have to go through it with you. That's not what Joshua the Gemara was asking. Okay, but it's I understand the channel, but as long as you understand what we're saying here, then the fact is that evil is around, you can grasp it and you can manipulate it. That's really what we need for this page. Alright, let's continue. Alright. There we go. The design, what did we get to? The design was that there'd be created devils that are good for God's creatures, the opposite was also created. And this is the essence of evil. I think we got to there, right? It would therefore be possible for evil to exist, so that through his own efforts, man would be able to remove it from his essence, as well as from creation in general. Now, in doing so, he would permanently establish good both in himself and in the universe as a whole, forever and ever, as we discussed in section one, all those pages back. It was therefore arranged that every good concept have its counterpart in evil. Pretty much what Clive just said earlier. This is what scripture means when it says in Koheles, God has made one opposite the other. There is one respect, however, in which the good is superior to evil. Now, this is very, very important. Good has its basis in God's own perfection. That's what good is. Good is a closeness to God, to whichever level that good could be. Some goods are more good than others, like, so they're lighter mitzvahs and heavier mitzvahs, as it were, which is without beginning or end. God is really intense. Evil, on the other hand, however evil it is merely something that was created, which means it's intrinsically imperfect, and will eventually be annihilated. Evil has to be temporary. Its purpose is to function only during the period of man's striving, as discussed earlier. Could you please tell me why it must be that evil has to be temporary? Logically, from what we have learned previously. For those that were here for term one and term two, which is like a couple of you, do you remember what's going on in Olam Haba? What is Olam Haba?
Scrubbing, washing, cleaning.
No, there's no scrubbing, washing or cleaning in Olam Haba.
After Mashiach comes, when it's going to go back to perfection.
Yes.
Waiting.
There's no waiting.
It was the...
No. Olam Haba. I'm not talking about that. I said Olam Haba.
Olam Haba is when the soul and the body reunite.
Right.
And gain and receive reward for the mitzvahs that they've...
Excellent, as a team. What will that reward consist of, Clive? Excellent. What is that reward?
That you would be at different levels according to your level of reward.
Right, but what is the reward?
Closeness to God.
Closeness to God. Why must that be the reward? Right, anything else would be deficient. Anything else he would give you wouldn't be good enough. Because if he gave you anything else, it wouldn't be perfect. And he can't give anything that's not perfect. Because he's perfect. So the only thing he can give you is him. Anything else he'd give you is deficient. And he can't bestow a deficient gift. There's no pleasure going to be greater than that, right? Okay. Why can't there be evil in that realm? If there was evil in Olam Haba, what would the problem be? Right, now if that deficiency was present, what's the problem?
You can't have a deficiency in
Hitler's as the
neighbours. Having Hitler's as the neighbours. The Hitler's moving next door. You've got the wonderful pad, and then the Hitler's turn up next door. Their mere presence removes the complete perfection of the good. You can't live next door to them. You can't be in the presence of evil. It will ruin the reward for the Tzaddikim. They just can't be there. It has to be utterly removed. Otherwise, the giving of God itself will be limited. And God can't limit himself. So Olam Haba has to be totally and utterly and completely and totally free of evil. Which means evil, therefore, must be temporary. So evil is limited by its nature that it must be temporary. Makes it all logical axioms, right? It's got to be temporary. Because if it existed forever, it would ruin what's coming tomorrow. Is that all clear? I know there's a lot of bad data. I'm trying, though. Point 9. According to these principles, then, it follows that just as God gave man a way to come to enlightenment and divine inspiration, which we're going to talk about in the very next chapter, which is new stuff, in a manner that transcends physical laws by making use of God's names, which we talked about previously, God also made it possible for man to bring upon himself darkness, pollution, and unclean spirit, also in a manner that transcends the laws of nature. There are several places you could look up here for the download. You should look up Devarim Yud Ches Yud. You should look up Shemais Chof Beis Yud Zayin. And Sanhedrin. Gemara Sanhedrin Samach Hay Omad Aleph. Okay, there's just some source notes there for you on the tape. This is the basis of such corrupt practices as sorcery and necromancy, which is communing with the dead, which are strictly forbidden by the Torah, sometimes by lashes and sometimes by death. The concept of such powers is that under appropriate conditions, this should be the word any, not an, any individual, that should be changed to A-N-Y, any individual can channel the influences of corruption and pollution through various incantations, full stop. What did we say? Can we just do a quick review about utilizing magical concepts previously? We learned that there's two things you could do. You could utilize God's names directly, or you could use one of God's names to bind an angel, an angelic seal. Now, that's type one and type two for those guys that were here previously. Type one is using God's names, a specific set of names at a specific time. We said that such an individual who does that, he himself or she herself, the practitioner, has key in utilizing this because it depends who they are. God doesn't have to bow to that spell, as it were, because he can overrule that. But he will if that person is a tzaddik. He will if that person is righteous. Type two, though, is merely playing with electrics. Anyone binding angels, as long as they know what they're doing, when they're doing it, and how they're doing it, it will work. Also here, utilizing forces of negativity work for anyone at any time. However, it comes with a warning. This should be highlighted for those that have highlighters or pencils to underline. This repels a person away from God more than anything else, and is the exact opposite of cleaving to him. It is better an individual prostrates himself in a church or idolatrous temple than does this. Because even worshipping a void Azorah is not as repulsive and God-distancing as these acts. This is the most despicable, horrendous, disgusting, abominable act a human being can do to ruin his own relationship with the Creator. This is it. This is the lowest of the low. Nothing could be worse. Because what you're doing is actually defiling yourself on purpose in order to manipulate these forces to go against the system which has been so carefully set up. You're literally polluting and corrupting the system meaningfully, with intent, voluntarily. It is just horrendous.
What are the influences and forces? And in the same way as the angels are there for, and the forces that we've talked about in the past that are there for good, where do these, are these all black angels, black forces?
Yes, they have to be encoded absolutely in the system to be accessible by man at any time.
So they're almost the opposite of what we've talked about.
That's correct.
And they exist.
They must. God can't not make them, because otherwise there'd be nothing to overcome.
And we, man, in the same way as man has ways of using, accessing the angels and through mitzvahs and everything, all the positive things we've talked about, there are ways of accessing the negative forces.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Like shading and things like
very
that.
Good. Very, very good. I want to remember we talked about angels, binding angels last time, and that we don't bind angels' names? Remember that? I'm going to read page 62 of the book Faith and Folly by Rabbi Yaakov Hillel. I'm just going to read it straight out, okay? When God appointed angels over his works, he commanded them to obey any person who utters their name and binds them with an oath in his name. Bang on what we're learning, right? By this method, our sages were able to change the course of nature, and under the correct circumstances, by forcing angels to fulfill their will. If a tzaddik who is free of sin and studies the Torah without ulterior motives engages in such oaths, we don't do this today, by the way, because of Shabbatai Tzvi, but this is the concept, he does honour to the Torah and to mitzvahs. But in our time, the Torah is neither observed nor studied properly, and people engage in oaths to acquire wealth and honour. Today, therefore, binding angels with oaths is forbidden. And he's bringing that from very classical Sfarim, which were written hundreds of years ago. Besides being forbidden, these oaths are dangerous. When people coerce an angel, listen to this, I think I discussed that with you last time, I'm not sure, the angel leads them astray, brings unnecessary blessings to their lips so that they should utter God's name in vain, and causes them to sin in order to destroy their souls. That's in Shah HaMitzvah in Parsha Shemais. The Arizal was careful not so much as to utter the names of angels, except for those which were also names of people, such as Michael and Gabriel. He would refer to those angels only by abbreviations of their names. The reason was that as soon as an angel hears his name mentioned on earth, he recoils in fright as he waits to hear whether humans are binding him with an oath. Even if it turns out that they're not, he bears a grudge against those who frightened him by uttering his name, and he will accuse them in Shah HaMitzvah's Parsha Shemais. In a conversation with his disciple, the Arizal revealed an additional reason. Rav Chaim Vital in Shah HaMitzvah's Parsha Shemais says, if it is permissible to mention certain names of God in prayer, for instance, why is it forbidden to mention the names of angels who are merely created beings? The Arizal replied to Rav Chaim Vital, when an angel's name is mentioned in this world, it becomes sullied by earthly impurity. God's names, however, are not affected by that. Only the ineffable name, which is the greatest of all names, must be concealed because of its great loftiness and sanctity. Another danger of mystical oaths is that if a person errs, even slightly, while trying to force the heavenly beings to help him, he will attract evil forces to him. In view of these extreme dangers, it is not surprising that the Rishonim, who are the halachic commentators who published their work before 1515 CE, the publication of the Shulchan Aruch, hid all the oaths. So they were already hidden by the 1500s. Any oaths quote-unquote known today are simply inaccurate and are dangerous to the user and anyone who would consult such a person using them. So the utilisation of oaths is basically a theoretical concept which is utterly impractical today. But the point is that we said last time is that anyone can utter an oath and it will work, but not anyone can utter God's names. I mean, they can, but it won't work unless they are of a prerequisite level of standing. If an individual wants to get involved with the negative side of things, as he's talking about demons or black negative angels, etc., you can do that too, but you run the same risk anyway. They don't like being called out of their tasks. If you call them out their tasks, then they are available. And that's what this means, getting involved with these sides of impurity. Okay, things such as these, at page 209, third indent down, things such as these are derived from the evil forces mentioned above. Now, I've highlighted the word corrupt incantations. It's extremely important. Corrupt incantations were provided through God's decree that when uttered can enable an individual to channel his unclean influence to specified levels in a supernatural manner. Through this, one can do things that are otherwise physically impossible, such as the various acts of sorcery that we discussed. All this follows from the power that they were given to function within specific areas. Notice you can't do anything you want. When you're mucking around with electrical forces or electrical wires, all you can do is adjust the voltages and amperes and charge that is actually coming out of the battery. All you can do is mess with the wires that are available to you. You can't do anything. You can only do what is going on at that time. So if you want to be involved with the Angel of Wind, let's say, you want to bind the Angel of Wind, you cannot make a volcano erupt or something like that. All you can do is blow down a tree at best. Do you understand what I'm saying? It can't work outside of its remit. All you can do is get it to do something which it wasn't meant to do. That makes sense to everyone so far, for those that are following? I know this
not
is...
not necessarily what it wasn't meant to do. It could be what it was meant to do, but not at that time.
Okay, yeah, outside of its remit.
Yeah.
It wasn't meant to do that then, and you say do it now, because you want to get it done. Yeah? That thing about the witchcraft that I was telling you about with the guy that made the guy that was treating the woman that was infertile, yeah? He didn't care about the fallout. He didn't care about the fact that angel was, you know, had to get that energy from someone else who was meant to be able to conceive, then he transferred it to someone else now who can't conceive. He couldn't care less, he just was after his wage, right? But as long as that angel or force could do that to that woman, he just was completely, he just didn't care, he just did it, right? Does that make sense? It was like an irresponsible act. Everyone clear so far? Leslie, you with me?
Yeah?
Yeah? Okay, I know this is very, very intense, but we're going to finish this whole thing in just a couple of paragraphs. Okay, things such as these can also be accomplished through shading, known as demons. This also depends on the exact ability within specific limited areas. Notice Pharaoh and in his Khartoumim, his necromancers would utilize demons. The most really that you can get demons to do is bring things from afar to you very quickly, so it will look as if you conjured it.
Where in our scheme of things did demons come
from? As we talked about in section 1 and the beginning of section 2, they're in Olam HaShadi. They're in the demonic world, which is neither physical and neither spiritual. They're basically close to what we would call Olam HaNeshamas, at the bottom end of Olam HaNeshamas. Yeah? To the degree that God's decree allows them to act, whatever force you tap into can push aside the angels that oversee nature and maintain things in their natural state. They can also do this to the angels that transmit God's influence according to the ordained system. Our sages therefore teach us that they are called sorcery because they go counter to the company on high. That was actually a statement of Rav Yochanan. You can see in the Hebrew, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines up, 3 words in from the end of the line, Keshofim. Literally kishuf. Why? Shemachishim pamalia shalmala. They go against the community on high. The word kishufim is taken out from these 3 words, right? I.e., there's nothing worse you can do than kishuf. Or you're basically ruining the system. You're hacking, cracking the system like a computer hacker that all he wants to do is steal money from the bank, completely and utterly unconcerned of the fact that it may ruin some other economy somewhere else. Okay, let's just knock out the last paragraph. All these forces, however, have certain limitations that they can't exceed. You can't overcharge or turbocharge anything, as we discussed last time, the concept of a turbocharged force. Even when they don't exceed their limitations, however, they can still be pushed aside by a greater force. So their function is precluded by God's decree. There's always going to be a safety valve. Even if you come along and say, right, I'm going to bind this angel, don't think that somehow God will now be bound to have to do what you want to do. This was the mistake of the people that built the Tower of Babel. Okay? They wanted to literally force God into a corner, which was their entire design program, and God just overrode it. You can't override God. Okay? The Torah thus states in Devarim, Hashem is God, there is none other than him. To which our sages add, even the power of sorcery. The Talmud explains that this is particularly true in the case of individuals whose merit is so great they're protected from on high. So those who wish to them ill are pushed aside. This is a tzaddik gomor, a perfect tzaddik. This is what the Talmud means to say when it says Rav Chanina is different and not affected by sorcery because his merit is so great. Rav Chanina ben Dosa is mentioned in the third perek of Tarnis, which is Eilisei the Tarnis, known often as Apurka de Chasida, the perek of the extremely pious, and it talks there about a certain list, Rav Chanina ben Dosa and Rav Elazar ben Pedas, who were absolutely phenomenally righteous individuals, and who were basically affected. People tried to utilize these negative forces against them, and they were completely immune, because they're literally outside of the system. Remember when Abraham was God encountered Abraham, and he said, you're going to have kids. Abraham argued with God and said, listen, I'm really sorry to, I don't mean to contradict you, but if you have a look at the stellar array, look at the zodiac, which is something that you've designed, it actually points out that based upon my stellar array, I can't have children. That's actually the system. God says, you're right. You're right. That is a system I've designed for you. You're quite right. But I'm going to take you outside of that system. Remember we talked about half of a quarter is three? Right, when we talked about the half of a quarter, that's a week of a month, right? Half of a quarter is 3.5 days. Remember we talked about that as a previous thing? God, the way that God relates to tzaddikim is to take them outside the natural order. That's how he actually shows them that he isn't relating to them on a standard system anymore. But that is exceptional and literally happens with a handful of individuals who become literally legendary. But basically, apart from these exceptional rules, one is that God can overrule the system, and there are certain people that are impervious from these things. This works for everyone and everything at all times. There are, of course, exceptions which prove the rule, which he's just bringing in that final section there. Okay, questions?
Does Bilaam trying to curse the Jewish people count as that?
I think that's a very good example. Bilaam came to try to curse the Jewish people and indeed had a special power that was given to him by God to curse people. He was very good at it. He made a good living at it. Kings, Balak, was employing him because he was well known to be a fantastic curser. But God said to him, listen, you can't curse that which is blessed. It just doesn't work. I'm not going to allow that to happen. Notice when we walk into shul, we say, Matavu Ohalecha, right? So how good. That means we walk in and say the words of someone who is desperately, like Adolf Hitler, Yimach Shemoy. Imagine he said, the Jews are good people, but I absolutely hate their guts. So could you imagine walking into shul every morning and go, so says Adolf Hitler, the Jews are good people, dot, 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 dot. Why on earth would we do that? Why would we walk into shul first thing in the morning and then say the words of the greatest Rosh Hashanah mentioned in Torah? Does anyone have any answer on that? It's a very interesting idea. What on earth would you do saying such words of such a wicked person?
Because they weren't his words, they were put into his mouth.
Yeah, but it came through Adolf Hitler's mouth. He's a disgusting person.
We're told that you can still learn things from a Rosh Hashanah, can't you?
But why state that?
Shows that, you know, even he recognized that.
Bingo, that's the Chassam Sofer. The Chassam Sofer explains that if someone who absolutely hates your guts, I mean loathes you properly, gives you a compliment, that compliment is true. It is the truest form of compliment. If someone mummish wants to kill you because they hate you so much, they say, you know what, very good, he always visits the sick or is extremely charitable, you can believe it, absolutely cast iron. If Bilaam HaRosha, who his whole mahus was to do something against the Jews, said that, you know, they live really well. You've got to say it. That is the ultimate level of Shvach V'Hodor that you're ever going to get. You're not going to get a compliment better. Because anyone else, the compliment isn't, could be a bit of flattery, could be a bit of this, could be a bit of that. He hates you. So if he hates you and he says you're wonderful, that we have to say the first thing as we walk in. So we can say to God as we walk in, people that loathe me have said this about me. So please, you know, give me a break. You know what I mean? See, I'm doing good because someone that really doesn't like me gave me this compliment. Yeah? Excellent, excellent. You're mechavan to the Chassam Sofer there. Fantastic. Yeah? You had a question?
We've learned that all this that we've learned, all the positive things is from Torah, Tanakh. everything that we're learning is based on that. All this negativity and sorcery and everything, where is all that information and all that?
In the witches help to guide.
Voracious 25, 5 through 6. When the patriarch Abraham grew old, Abraham gave all that he had to Sarah's son Yitzhak. But to the children of his concubines, Abraham gave gifts. Then he sent them away from Yitzhak his son in order to make a good differentiation, while he was still alive, eastward towards the Orient. The Zohar HaKadosh, Rav Shimon Bar Yochai explains, Chelek Aleph, page 100a, and 133b and 233a. He gave the children of his concubines the names of the forces of impurity and banished them to the lands of the east, which are places of sorcery. He thereby clearly separated them from Yitzchak and his own seed, whose portion is in sanctity. To this day, sorcery is common in the lands of the east. That's right. There's a lot actually to talk about here. Sorcery forbidden to... he goes on to it about a great length actually. But the point was that this material was known to Abraham. He wrote Sefer Yetzirah. At least the first 240 words were written by Avraham Avinu. So he was a master astrologer and he was into all this kind of material. But he didn't... That's not for Yitzchak. This stuff was known about, but it was literally cast aside, because the Yiddish portion is going to be profoundly different to anyone that needs to tap into this material. The need to tap, by the way, a very interesting thing. I'm going off. I spoke to Rabbi Yaakov Hillel about this. And Rabbi Yaakov Hillel is often called in into places like Tel Aviv and Holon, which are secular areas of Israel, to sort out Ouija boards that go bonkers. Okay, people get freaked out. They buy an MB game, you know, Ouija board, and they play games, and something goes wrong. They can't explain it, the parents freak out, they call the police, and the police in Tel Aviv end up calling Rabbi Yaakov Hillel. Mamish, true thing. He goes there and sorts this out. But he always gets the teenagers or whoever's doing it always to promise they're never going to get involved in this again. I spoke to Rabbi Noach Orlowick about this. Rabbi Noach Orlowick is a Mishkiach Ruchni in Torah or Yeshiva, which is what I studied. He's a very well-known published author. And I spoke to him about it. I said, why is it often that you get teenagers and adolescents involved in these kinds of black magic and Ouija? What is going on? You generally don't find people in their 60s sitting around playing Ouija board. I don't know. Is it, do you generally see? But generally, it is of a younger generation. Rabbi Orlowick explained to me a very profound concept, which I'd like to share with you. It's a very simplistic concept, but it's nonetheless very profound. People are only ever obsessed with that which they do not have. If you truly own and have control over something, you're not obsessed with it. If an individual, let's say, is obsessed with money, the money that he has isn't his. It controls him. Adolescents, there's a Gemara in Gittin, a beautiful Gemara that says one of the things you should do for children is to give them pottery. Cheap pottery. Just give it to them. Let them break it. Let them break it. The same Gemara in Gittin then says, children love money. Children love money. Give a kid a £50 note. Let him go to the store. Let him go to any shop. And suddenly this grown man or woman behind the counter is now their slave. They just have to stand with a piece of paper and go, get me that. You go, oh, which one do you want? This one? This one? Is this a good one? Yeah, and get me that. Yeah, okay, fine, okay. Whoa, this piece of paper! It's fantastic! This piece of paper is giving me power over that person. The reason is children and adolescents don't have much influence in the world. They just don't. That's part of the problem of being a child and adolescent. Giving them something to break is an extremely good idea, because breaking or destroying something shows a tremendously high level of control over an item. You generally don't give them something you want them not to break. So they don't break it, they don't touch it. They give them something to break. That's the Gemara. And Rabbi Noach Orlowick explained about Yaakov Hillel's words, saying like this: children and adolescents want to feel as if they have power and influence in the world. A quick way into power and influence is the forces of impurity. They're easy to get to. They're relatively simple to trap. You have nine, and they do stuff. So it's basically a bit of fun. What they don't realise is that it's an extremely dangerous pastime. This is why the vast majority of people that he has to go sort out in Tel Aviv are teenagers. It's actually, it's attractive to them, this kind of stuff, because they want instant influence. And people at that age don't have that much power or influence in the world. So it becomes extremely attractive to people that wouldn't have influence and want a quick influence burst. They want to be able to affect things. That was an interesting thing that I heard directly from Rabbi Yaakov Hillel, and that was explained to me later by Rabbi Noach Olawik. That kind of repletes out these kind of concepts as to why people would get involved in such. But at the end of the day, to quote someone else who was learning this stuff, he's just, it's a mug's game. That really is a very true thing. It really is a mug's game. You're very unlikely to get anything truly beneficial and potent out of the whole experience, except for basically a headache. We know that Solomon, King Solomon, who's the wisest man who ever lived, he was wiser than the Mashiach will be. The Messiah will not be as wise as Solomon. The Messiah will not be as great a prophet as Moshe Rabbeinu. Apart from those two limitations, he'll be as good as it gets. But he won't be as great in prophecy as Moshe. He will not be as great in wisdom as Solomon. Solomon got involved with the Shin Dalits. He got involved with demons. And he got tricked out of his throne. According to Beis Hillel, he lost his throne for 33 years. According to Beis Shammai, he never regained his throne. So Rav Yaakov Hillel explains in his writings, if Solomon, who's the wisest man who's ever lived, got involved with these negative forces and lost out big to them, how much more so everyone else? Okay. However, these forces are accessible and you can have a go at them, right? He's got to tell you that because he's not hiding anything from you in this book. Everything from A to Z is absolutely all in here, right? So he's got to like not leave any pebble unturned. So we've discussed it. So as a bit of revision, we've got three levels here. What are the levels? Level number one is utilization of God's names. Level number two is utilization of angelic seals. And level number three is the manipulation of demons. Level one can only be done by an individual who it's fitting for that person to be done. Otherwise, it's not going to work anyway. Level two and three can be done by anyone. You, me, anyone, you name it. It'll just work. As long as you know the electrics and when to do it and how to do it, it's going to work. Thus endeth that chapter.
You're mentioning about these great sophos and rabbanim who are very, very witty up there.
Are you talking about Rav Chanina ben Dosa and those mentioned in Pirkei de Chasida?
Yeah.
These Siddiqim Gemurim, 100%. Yeah.
What's the correlationship and why with the fact that some of these rabbanim are not decomposing?
I can't go into that now. It's a separate topic. I don't know that Rav Chanina ben Dosa didn't decompose. I can't go into that regarding the Vilna Gaon. At least his bones were all very intact when they moved his body, etc. There's no impurity that needs to be. That's a separate thing. That's a separate thing. I can go into that, but it's not for now. Is that okay? Because it takes us too off topic. Yeah.
Just clarify. Are these forces inherently bad, or are they just being used inappropriately? So, for instance, if a tzaddik uses a force for a positive purpose and a rosha uses the same force for a negative purpose, is it the same force or are they inherently bad?
No, that's a very, very complicated question that you're asking. Andy's asking like this. When you're tapping into these forces, what you're tapping into, the answer is, let me just explain. There are positive forces and there are negative forces. Mm-hmm. A tzaddik is not going to tap into a negative force. It's only going to tap into a positive force. Someone who isn't a tzaddik and decides to do this anyway, he doesn't know really what he's doing. He's more than likely going to tap into negative force because they're either to tap into. If he's going to tap into a positive force and get it to be manipulated, it will then turn into something negative.
Yes.
That's how it works.
So you're saying they are inherently negative forces?
Yes, there are such things called, that their job is to cause makalkel, their job is to cause damage.
Mm.
Now, Kodesh Baruch Hu had to put that in because there's damage in the world, right? I mean, you know, someone steps on a landmine, there has to be a negative force to shatter his body. I mean, that's just how it works. It's a terrible thing. But that force has to be encoded to allow it to happen.
So I'm thinking of the example of, you know, the famous bringing of the golem to fight against the Nazis.
Well, it was earlier than that. Yeah. It was much earlier. It was the fight against the local anti-Semites.
Yes, right, yeah, I'm just saying, he's bringing in a negative force which would cause damage, but he did it to defend the Jewish people.
Well, that wasn't a negative force. What he did there was to channel life in the same way that God channels life. That's not utilize.
Yeah.
He was not utilize. Now again, remember, like, the time of the Gemara. The Gemara says that every Erev Shabbos they would create a calf at a third level of maturity in Shechtet and eat it on Shabbos. Mm. That's not utilizing of a negative force. It was just utilizing the concept of life force in order to animate that which is inanimate. Mm. But again, these creatures don't have the full status of a full being. That cow doesn't need Shechita, and that person isn't technically a person. You know, you can't count him as a minion. He's not a person.
Yeah.
He's an animated clod of earth.
Yes, no.
Right. He can't speak. He doesn't have divine gift of speech, etc.
Why didn't they create him as a golem for the Holocaust?
No one great enough in the world that was permitted to do such. The Vilna Gaon at the age of 9 could create a golem. And he asked of heaven, he did a Shilas Cholom, he asked of heaven, can I please create a golem merely as a theoretical thing in order to enhance my learning? The answer came back saying no. There's no need for it. You don't need to do that. The Maharal did it because it was needed at that time. But there's no Maharal at the time of the Holocaust. There's no one of that stature that was around. You just have no. We have no idea who the Maharal was. It was just like his level of learning and saintliness and purity is just like, you know, abound in legend. Whether or not the Golem actually did or didn't exist already is a point of contention. I'm not saying it did or it didn't. Some people say, you know, it's just a story. Other people say very clearly that it did exist. His name was Yossel HaGolem. I don't know what to tell you. But whether or not it's a fable, whether or not it's real, I'm talking as if it is real to be able to go on to the conversation. But whether it was or wasn't is up for contention.
And clearly that wasn't a negative force that brought him.
No, clearly it wasn't. I mean, it was made by the Maharal and his two top disciples. Yeah? They certainly wouldn't have been channeling negative forces, those individuals. Can I continue? Are we good to continue? Right, we're going to start a new topic. Thank goodness. For all those people who are new, we can put that one previously to bed. And now we're going to start a completely new section. And this taps into the concept of the soul. Now, if you remember back, way back when we introduced the soul, I don't have any spare sheets of this, unfortunately. And Dovey is left, so I can't get some photocopies. But we had this piece of paper. Remember this piece of paper? No? Yeah? We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 spheres. And these are all different levels of the anatomy of the human soul, as explained by the Derech Hashem. And at the bottom, we have the animal soul. Then we have the spirit of speech. Then we have the human soul. Then we have the life force of the soul. Then we have the unique spiritual identity, and all 6 components over here make up one human soul. So that every human soul is actually a chain of spiritual anatomy, as it were, each one linking to another. Each one is discrete and circumscribed by its own dimensions, as it were, and each one links with the other, and they fit into one another, utilizing the telescope concept, right? Where one is higher than another, right? And they interface at the most outer level of one, interfaces with the most inner level of the next one down. And that's how this works. Okay, for all those individuals, a little bit of revision there in the human soul. This proves, by the way, that the soul cannot be a part of God. It is absolutely, totally impossible that be true, because it has components. God can't have any components because he's simple. The fact that it has components and they join to each other to make a whole makes it deficient. God isn't deficient, and God does not split himself up into little bits. Okay? So the concept of God being the soul is false. Okay? We learned that logically, that there's no way that could work on several grounds. Okay? All right. So we're now going to touch into the concept of what this soul can do for us, as it were. We're on page 213. We're starting a brand new chapter called Inspiration and Prophecy, or Ruach HaKodesh and Nevuah. Okay, everyone good to go? Yeah, the questions came in really quick on that one. Yeah, well, Clive.
I know we discussed all this previously, but since discussing that, I think I was talking to somebody who suggested, they were saying that there's soul that we don't that a that so a part of our soul is shared with other souls, that we don't there isn't just this unique individual soul that each one of us has, that part of it we do, that there's a some larger soul that we tap into, or larger parts of the soul that are on a grander scale. And I said, well, that's not what we learn. So I'd ask, I thought of that.
I'm not quite sure if I got it. Yeah, it's I can hear where the muddled bit comes into the question. Some people, let's say you have a whole, just very quickly, you have a whole human soul. If you've got a whole human soul, that's not shared with anyone else. Okay? It just isn't. And that's that. However, that, the top bit of that, is plugged into the bottom of these guys, in the bottom of the guys. So this is plugged in there. Now, you may be very, very close to someone else. I had a long discussion. Can I go off and talk about my very long discussion I had with someone that asked me a long question? I think it may be useful for you.
Can we have a copy of those for next week?
Belinada. Which means yes.
I know that.
It's like this. It's a very, very, very important concept that I'd like to share.
The shortest answer you've ever given.
Really? Wow. I ought to flesh it out for next time. Well, I don't know. Maybe. I mean, what is a copy? Okay. You're like this. I think you're like this. This is really... I hope you'll get it. I really do hope you'll get this. This is really cool. You're talking about connections of souls, which does link in with the inspiration prophecy, which we're going to talk about. It's like this. Hear this out. Good. I don't have a prop. Okay. I was just thinking.
There's all the strands.
Yeah. Oh, you're ahead of me here. You got it. Okay. Do you know why, by the way, Jewish men put talisim over their shoulders before they put them on?
Check the knots.
Why can't they check the knots anyway?
They have to check with the talisim.
So they can do it in the bag. Why do I have to put it over my shoulder? Shmartem es mitzvahs. Don't pass over the mitzvahs. Once you've picked up a mitzvah, you're not allowed to put it down until you've used it. Once I've picked up the talis, I can't put it down to check the knots. So I can't pick up my talis and go, oh, I haven't checked the knots, and do that, and actually check it. Because now I've picked it up, it's forbidden for me to put it down. You've got to guard the mitzvahs. We learn out, you can't put it down. That's why, by the way, you should always stack your tefillin where you know they are in the bag. Because you've got to pick the tefillah shel yad up first. So if you pick up the tefillah shel rosh, you can't put it down because it's a mitzvah that you've got to use. So I've done this, and I put him in the wrong side, and I picked my tefillah shel rosh first, and I managed. I just want to say it is actually humanly possible to hold that in one hand, and actually still put on my tefillah shel yad without dropping the tefillah. But it could be helped that maybe you're a concert guitarist. If you're a concert guitarist, and good with your hands. Always be a concert guitarist. Oh, this talis isn't kosher. Psh, what a mitzvah, hey? L'shem mitzvah sitzis. What the chances? Wasn't a double knot there? So, well, I'm here. This next guy is going to use it. This talis is not kosher. You can't use this talis.
Maybe if you put that special.
I have to put this. You cannot use this talis.
Maybe that was why it was put to one side.
Yeah.
No. That was being used there. People were going to put this on without checking. This talis is a non-kosher talis. This has to be... It's just not done. You can't use this. Okay? You have to tell... Can I give this to you to give... You can't use this for davening until it's been done. Okay? So it's good anyway. I can put this on at night because there's no mitzvah sitzis. This is a non-kosher talis.
The Kohen should say...
Okay. Oh, no, Kohen should take... Okay, yeah, okay. I'll put it all on Ronnie. Ah, fingers of the Kohen. It's like this. So I was talking about souls before I could completely take... You can see I've gone off when I'm going off. You can see how terrible it is. I'm really trying... I know, it's terrible. Terrible. I know. Now look. These branches... Imagine these are the branches of the Kohas. Imagine these are the branches of the things coming down. Now, the ends of each branch, let's say, is one Jewish soul. What's your first name again?
Howard.
Okay, Howard. Can I ask you to hold one Jewish soul? Ronnie, I'm going to need you just to take another Jewish soul. Okay, you can probably sit on your seat, right? Okay, and Andy, can you take another soul? Look at this. Wow, this is awesome. Can you see this? Now, Ronnie, Howard, and Andy are all pulling souls off the bottom of the same root of that primordial force. Can you see that? This is vital. You live in France, you live in Manchester, and you live in Germany. This has got nothing to do with your physical location on the earth. This has to do with your spiritual root ascendancy. Do you hear what I'm saying? Is everyone clear what I'm talking about? Now listen to me very, very carefully. He's got his Nefesh Bahamas, he's got his animal soul, then he's got his Ruach, he's got his spirit of speech, then he's got his Neshama, then he's got his Chaya, which is the life force of the Neshama, and then he's got his Yechida, and it's the Yechida which is attached to the knot. You with me so far? Now his Yechida is attached to the knot, and his Yechida is attached to the knot. And then if you go all the way down, you get to his physical goof down in Manchester, France, and Germany. But the Yechidas, the unique spiritual identity, are all shared on the same root. You hear this? Now watch this. I'm not saying about Andy, I'm just saying about who Andy would represent. Andy decides he's going to have a pork sandwich. For whatever reason. Now Andy therefore sends pollution, negativity, up through this strand. Now, Howard, okay, who's living in France, okay, was thinking about doing another Avera. He was thinking about doing an Avera in France. He was not sure whether he was going to do it. But because the pollution coming in from this line over here is now negating the root knot, it's polluting this line and this line. And these two end characters at the end are far more likely to fall into an Avera because he's polluted the system. Have you ever heard the famous Gemara, every Jew keeps Shabbos, the Mashiach will come?
Yeah.
How does this work? Let's say he decides he's going to put on tefillin. He cleanses up an energy that goes up here from France and he says, you know what, today I'm going to keep Shabbos, just for this 1 week. Where did that energy come from? Because he's energized it up this route. So there's a guy in France, there's a guy in Manchester, and there's a guy in Germany, and they all get a boost. After 120 years, God says, you know what? You remember that guy in Germany and that guy in Manchester? He goes, no, I don't remember anything to that. You made them their mitzvahs! Because they're all coming from the same route. If a Jew in France eats a pork sandwich, a Jew in Manchester will marry out. If a Jew in Manchester keeps Shabbos, a Jew in France will dump his non-Jewish girlfriend. Kol Yisrael Oreivim Ze Leze. All Israel are bound to one another. That's because the roots can be... Now, that root has nothing to do with this root. It's a totally separate bunch of roots. This guy lives in New Zealand. This guy lives in Zimbabwe. This guy lives in Rhodesia, this guy lives in Israel, and that's off a different route. But this is connected to the same talus, the same chain which is connected to this other route. It's just this guy's not a spiritual brother to these three guys. These three guys are spiritual brothers. They'll never meet in their whole lives. But they're considered spiritual brothers because their roots are shared. But there's other roots. How many core roots, how many strands are there in Israel? 600,000 of these strands. But there's less core roots. There's less core roots. But all those core roots come out of the same pool. Brilliant. This is the concept that when one Jew does a mitzvah in one place, if all Jews started keeping a Shabbos, the whole system will be fixed. Because it's all connected to the same root. That's how it works. That's how the system operates. That's how your behavior now is affecting Jews in Italy. And you'll be rewarded or punished for that. After 120, if you push the boat and you perfect your route, that route is of course connected to all those others on your soul route, which means everyone got an aliyah or yurida based upon your actions. This is the concept of all Israel act as guarantors for one another. That's the Pasuk. Which is why when Moses was saying at the punishment of the golden calf, all that everyone should take up his sword and they should strike down his friend, his brother, or his relative. What's the difference between a brother and a relative? The brother's the spiritual brother. But it could be your relative. It's got nothing to do with you. It could be your actual physical brother. It's from a totally different route. The neshama he's being assigned is from a is like the other end of the ball. But your spiritual brother, he lives in New Zealand. And he's mamish directly off the same strand as you. But you both had different yechidas. But they're connected to a... This is Apostle Talis. Can I give this to you?
That needs fixing.
Yeah? Does that answer your question? We went off, but I think it was kind of worth it.
So it is. So souls are connected.
At the top end of the yechida, souls are connected. And that's how pollution or perfection that goes up can spread down web-like to people you've never met.
But we've all got our own individual souls.
Yes.
And different levels of individual souls.
Very good. That pool has roots. Some come out low, some come out middle, some come out high. That's right.
Don't we believe we get reincarnated at different levels?
We may or may not. If you need the reincarnation, if you've done something wrong and you need that perfection, you need to come back for a second rule, which we've discussed previously, then yes. What happens when you marry someone else? It's very interesting. You've got that pool going on and you're like one strand, right? And Ronnie and Howard and Andy are all on that one strand. Then you meet a girl and she's from a totally different strand. Then those two neshamas merge. And what you have is an intertwining from two totally... This is the concept of a zivug. It's much better if you can to marry someone on the same strand. Doesn't mean you have to be in the same country, same ethnicity or anything like that. You're going to be much more in tune with your life task if you marry someone on the same strand. This is the concept of a zivug, but it is not necessary. You do not have to marry a zivug.
Is there any correlation with DNA with this?
Yes, there is, but that would take me an hour. Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, that would take me an hour to discuss. We don't have that time. But yes, there is. Absolutely, there is. However, the DNA is limited. It is limited. It's limited.
Mitochondrial DNA.
No. Cellular, nuclear DNA. No, cellular DNA.
But the mitochondrial, the carbonium is passed from a mitochondria.
No.
The mitochondria is just the energy.
No.
That's another discussion. Yeah, it's another discussion. No. Kahanim are missing certain codons. That's what's going on. That's what we find. And Leviim are missing others. That's what we found. But all Jews that are tested, certainly all Ashkenazi Jews, all stem from four women. There's no doubt about that whatsoever genetically. Okay? That's Rochel, Leah, Bilhah, and Zilpah. Those are the four women. They haven't done tests on those in order to be able to figure that out. Sephardim, if tribe Yehuda, Ashkenazim, tribe Benjamin. That's our Messiah. With that, we'll jump in to inspiration and prophecy. We'll make a go of it for a bit. This is really awesome. Most people do not know what the word prophecy means. Could I just take a random ask from all of you? Adrian, I'm just going to go around the room. What does prophecy mean?
Being able to predict the future.
Okay, full stop. Andy?
Hear the words of Hashem.
Okay, Howard?
Yeah, foreseeing something in the future.
Foreseeing something.
Yeah.
Leslie? Same. Lorani?
Somebody that's aware, sensitive, and aware.
What? Say that again. Prophecy means?
Somebody who's more attuned, more aware, and more sensitive.
Okay.
Impulses coming in.
Clive?
Somebody, I think prophecy, foreseeing the future.
Foreseeing the future. Mrs. Links.
The prophets were people who had messages from God, so I assume that that's what Nebuah is used for.
Okay, and late Karen.
I thought it was somebody who could foresee what would happen in the future.
Right, the only person who's on it is Ronnie. Okay.
It's not fair for me because I've never seen a prophet. So.
Well, probably Ronnie hasn't either.
I've never made one. Yeah.
So, Ronnie, repeat again.
Really, what.
He was sensitive, more aware, and attuned.
All prophecy is, just to give you the answer, is a higher state of consciousness. That does not necessarily mean that God's going to give you what to talk about. All the prophets that we know about are the ones that wrote down a message that they received while in that higher state of consciousness. But that does not mean that all prophets had that message. How many prophets were there in Israel? Not including the Mount Sinai experience. As brought down by our sources.
Millions.
Can you tell me, can you give me a number?
Give you a number of millions.
I want a specific number. Our Chazal tell us that there's a certain number of prophets that existed in Israel.
3 million.
No. 1.2 million. 600,000 men, 600,000 women were prophets. That's excluding the 4.2 million Jews that stood at the Mount Sinai experience.
Can we name them?
No.
Telephone
directory. No. It's not the case of naming them. The ones that you can name are the ones that were canonized into a Bible. But those are only because their particular prophecy that they received was important for all time.
So where do we get this number
from? Chazal. Chazal go through the exact thing over the ages that Hashem gave over 1.2 million. What does this mean? It means 1.2 million people, frankly, developed themselves to the level where anyone could get to it. They moved to broadband. Everyone's on dial-up, and they moved to broadband. That's all that happened.
They weren't chosen to receive a message. That
prophecy isn't that.
It's being attuned.
That's it. It's just plugging in. If you plug in, you are a prophet.
But there's no signal being...
There is always signal being relayed, but it may not have anything to do with you. You're just tapping in to a whole mainframe of data which you don't even know is going on. If you manage to consciously get to that, you are a prophet.
So we can't be prophets.
We daven for prophecy today, that you can still be prophets today. The only thing that you can't be is a grand prophet. There's five levels of prophecy which we're going to learn about. The top level, grand prophecy, has been closed for us today.
Okay, so we've still got four other levels.
We've got loads of others.
If Hashem must give you the gift.
No. You have to work for it.
You have to work for it.
Shem doesn't give you the gift.
So you say it's like a radio broadcast that you tune in.
Excellent! Excellent! Most people are working on FM, but prophecy is on shortwave. If you are able to move your mental dial in, you too will be a prophet. That does not mean you will get any kind of information as to who's going to win the 330 with going good to firm. Prince's Pride, put your money on it. That's not what it is. It may be! If, when you've tuned in to short, maybe the God might decide to broadcast to you a particular thing. Very unlikely. Even if you get there. And if he does, he uses root hubs and servers, who are the arch prophets of the generation who receive everyone else's prophecy, because they become the local antennas. We're going to discuss that. This is mummish mind-blowing. Most Jews have no idea what prophecy is. None at all. God talking to you ain't prophecy. Being a prophet just means you're conscious. They get out of bed in the morning, they're more conscious than you. That is all that is happening. They're prophets. That's how it works. They may only ever prophesize once in their career. Through meditative act. And they'll never have a prophecy again. They're prophets. That's how it works. They may have regular prophecy. They may have high-level prophecy. They may have low-level prophecy. They may have a mix. They're prophets. That's it. Whether or not they get data in that they've got to act upon, it's a totally separate thing that we'll discuss. Prophecy is a heightened state of consciousness. That is all. 99.9% of Jews don't have that clear. That's what our sources tell us. The Derech Hashem isn't teaching us anything. He isn't teaching us any of his own Torah. He's just culling it from the entire Torah. That's all he's doing. It's an encyclopedia. It's a reference work. He's not making any of this up himself. Okay?
Is that why we call Moshe Rabbeinu the greatest prophet? Not because of what he predicted in the future, but because of his highest level of awareness to be able to speak to Shem.
Excellent. He was the most attuned person who was or will ever live.
But it wasn't actually what he predicted as what he... As his
it happens to be that because of his extremely exalted level... In fact, I'm going to say something that's going to sound like utter heresy... I want you to be very careful about who you say this to. I'm going to prove it later with a pasuk. We're not going to do it now. Moses wasn't a prophet. He was the prophecy itself. He was the transmission. Who was the prophet? Aaron. God elevated him to the level of a prophecy class being, the actual transmission itself. That's why he's Avnavim. It's actually not even fair to lump Moshe Rabbeinu together with any other prophet. It's not fair.
Did you say Moshe was the aerial?
No. He was the transmission.
Transmission surely was Hashem.
No. We'll talk about it. He was the angelic class being whose job it was to actually prophesy.
Is that when his face changed?
No, that's later. He already had that. That was different. That was different. That was a certain stage of his prophetic development. God actually elevated him. He already in his first job at the snare. He said, "I'm going to make you a god to Pharaoh, and Aaron will be your spokesman." What's the word for spokesman in the Torah? Nivi'echa. Aaron will be your prophet. You'll be an Elohim to Pharaoh. You'll be an angelic class being, and Aaron will be your prophet. You'll be the prophecy. It's unfair even to other prophets to compare them to him. It's not fair. They're only getting the reception. He was the transmitter. We'll talk about that. That's what it means he's Avnavim. He's on a totally different... So much so. In this book, look at this. On page 221, we've got the prophetic experience. Yeah? Mm-hmm. And then, on page 239, you've got a whole separate chapter called Moses is a prophet. He needs to be treated differently. You can't learn anything that we learned previously about regular prophets to him. He has to be completely treated as a different category in and of himself. He's just different. And we'll learn why that had to be. Which is why, by the way, he had to be egoless. He had to be utterly free of tainted ego.
Why he was the humblest man.
Humblest man that ever lived. He had to be egoless because he had to be a clear transmission device. Because his job was to give over the Torah. Now, when Daniel wrote a book, what do we call that book? We call that Sefer... When Habakkuk wrote a book, what do we call it? We call that Sefer? Okay. When Shmuel wrote a book, we call it Sefer? When Moshe wrote a book, we call that Sefer?
Torah.
Why is that not Sefer Moshe?
Or we could also call it five books of Moses.
That's correct. Why don't we don't call it Sefer Moshe. We call it Sefer Daniel, Sefer Habakkuk. We always say Sefer Yonah. We never say Sefer Moshe. Give me a Sefer Moshe.
Why was he allowed to marry a non-Jewish woman?
Yes. Because he's converted her.
Okay.
So did Solomon.
Everyone
that he married, he converted himself.
But when
did he marry her?
When he left.
When he left where?
Egypt.
Where did he go when he left Egypt?
Who are we talking about?
Midian. No, he didn't. He went to Ethiopia.
Yeah, became a king.
Became a king. Then he ran away from Ethiopia and found his way to Midian. All pre-Torah. Who was a Jew pre-Torah? There were no Jews.
Okay.
Page 213, point one, inspiration and prophecy. This is awesome. God ordained, he put into the system, completely new idea, that man should naturally be able to teach himself. Know when it's warm, know when it's cold, know how to find food. He should understand and reason with his intellect and thus gain knowledge from his observation of things and their properties. A little bit of science there. On the basis of this, man's also able to infer and deduce things that are not immediately apparent. I know, red sky at night. Red sky morning. Sailor's warning, shepherd's delight. I've started to infer and deduce. I know when it's a red sky night, it'll be nice tomorrow. But if a red sky morning, it'll probably be a bit windy. So I can infer and deduce. Maybe I should put on some extra clothing tomorrow morning, lay it out on the bed before I get up. Because I've learned that and I've deduced that from experience. And can thus gain a more complete understanding of things. This is the natural process of human reason. But God also decreed, however, that there exists another means of gaining knowledge that is much higher than this. This is what we call, highlight, bestowed enlightenment. Bestowed enlightenment, the bottom level of prophecy. Bestowed enlightenment consists of an influence granted by God through various particular means, which we will discuss, especially prepared for this purpose. A certain influence which God gave to human beings, be them Jew or Gentile, who, if they would hit the prerequisite level that's necessary, they'll be able to tap into a higher data stream. When this influence reaches an individual's mind, certain information becomes fixed in it. He perceives this knowledge clearly, without any doubt or error. This, by the way, is a key marker. Someone who's experienced prophecy is in no doubt of it, and knows it completely, with all of its propositions and corollaries, as well as its place in the general scheme. This is called divine inspiration. That is a higher level, an influx knowledge known as Ruach HaKodesh. Haskala HaNishbas is bestowed enlightenment. Ruach HaKodesh is a more intense experience of that. In this manner, one can gain knowledge of things otherwise accessible to human reason. Put that at point one. Put a little one next to that. Let's say that if I build a huge, large Hadron Collider and put it under CERN and smash very, very small things together and learn about the Higgs boson, right, that I could learn about subatomic particles. I could do that. Or I could get prophecy about it. There's two ways of getting the same data. I'd know about the Higgs boson via prophecy, or a low level of prophecy, or I would know about the Higgs boson via scientific endeavour. Both of those are ways to find out about things which are hidden from me at the moment. I could get them through either channel. But if I get it through prophecy, it's in a much clearer way than if I learn about it through scientific endeavour, because there's no ambiguity. Because there's no ambiguity being transmitted on that data string. On the other hand, one can also gain information that simply could not otherwise be gained through any natural mean. There, that's point two. There's certain things which are available through prophetic influx, which doesn't matter what scientific endeavor or ability is granted to man, you will never be able to understand this through physical means. At all, ever. It's simply outside that realm. This includes such things as information concerning future events and hidden secrets. This is the differentiation between point one and point two. Point one is I will gain a clear understanding of that which I could have found out about anyway. It's just a very clear way of doing it. Point two is I can gain a clear understanding of that which I cannot find out any other way. Those are the two things which are available at this data stream. Is that clear? This experience, however, can take place on many different levels. These may involve the power of its influence, the time when it is granted, the manner in which it reaches the individual, and the nature of the things revealed and communicated in that fashion. A lot of variables. There's no fixed, set menu for prophecy. In every case, however, the influence comes in such a manner that the recipient, whoever he or she is clearly aware of it. There's no ambiguity. This is if I think something was transmitted to me. No. Data has been transmitted. You were getting fiber broadband, at that moment.
Are we just passive? Or have we got to, because we were talking before about we've got to be attuned. So presumably we're not just passively receiving. We've got to be...
That's a very slick question. Mrs. Lynx is saying like this. What are we doing? What is the practitioner doing at this time? It's a double-fold answer to your question. You can't be passive to get there. But once you're there, you can't be anything but passive. Let me explain by means of a metaphor and an analogy. You wish to upgrade from dial-up 56K broadband somewhere in the sticks in Tasmania. And a phone company says, we could give you fiber broadband. That's a lot of work. First of all, you've got to pay them. Then you've got to book the BT engineers to come round. They've got to drill a hole in your wall. Got to put a new box in. They give you a router. Then they go away. Then they call you up and say, your router's ready. You need to do this. And you need to sit by the computer. And you need to press the buttons. Then you need to run downstairs to press the button on the router when they say. Then you need to tell them, the green light is flashing. And they're like, okay, tap in this secret number into the thing. Lots of work. You got to get there. You got to get the technology there, right? But then the receiving of fiber broadband speeds, you're completely passive. You've done everything you need to do to allow that data stream in, but the data stream is now pouring in. It's like water pouring through a pipe. There's a tremendous amount of energy to put a pipe in, and the copper and the soldering. And but then when you want to go, when you turn on a bath or something like that, the water just comes up by itself. You're passive. The bath is nearly a passive receptacle. To get to the status of prophecy takes a tremendous amount of effort on behalf of the practitioner. But once that prerequisite effort has worked, prophecy is merely what's pouring into the consciousness of that mind. Do you hear that answer? Is everyone clear with what I've just said? Andy? Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ronnie, Howard, everyone? You're totally happy with what I've said there? That's a very good question, because that really answers up a lot of the issues that will crop up when talking about this. The effort put in is tremendous activity, but when you get there, you're nothing but totally passive. No, because their consciousness is the final filter. What a great question. Two people get two exact prophecies. The exact prophecy. It's about an egg falling on the ground. But one guy was educated in English literature at Balliol College, Oxford. And one guy is a barrow boy from Petticoat Lane. And they both reach the prerequisite status of prophecy. And God is talking about the egg falling to the ground, and they happen to be tapping in at that time, and they both got the exact same prophecy. The guy from Balliol College, Oxford, behold, an oocyte in its final stage, falleth through the air, smashes powerfully on the ground, leaving, you know, that's how it speaks. Bad boy, like, oh, it looks like an egg fell on the ground, didn't it? That's what he perceives. His consciousness will tint and filter the final data. Because it depends on your router. Your router is your consciousness. That's not passive. You could argue that my consciousness is that, but really at the end of the day it's passive. At that stage, it's whatever you got to work with. That's why Yeshaya was the greatest of all the prophets next to Moshe. He was so beautiful and eloquent. When you read Treyasa like Habakkuk and Avadiah, they seem a bit thick cut next to him. But that's because that's who they were. They didn't have his eloquence.
But it's still the same message. Egg falls to ground.
That's if it's the same message. But 99.9% of the time, they didn't receive the same messages. Right. But whoever receives one message, the arch prophet of the door has to receive that message. He will get that. That means Eliyahu knew about Yonah's mission to go to Nineveh, because he was the arch prophet of the door while Yonah was alive. Yonah was a Talmud of Elisha, and Elisha was a Talmud of Eliyahu. The top Navi that lived at that time was Elijah. He became one of the rooters. We'll talk about that. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Where do we get to? Oh, did we get to, it is also possible, however, this is awesome. It is also possible, however, that such influence be extended to a person's mind so that he can clearly perceive a given concept without his being aware of this influence. He will be unaware that he's receiving prophecy, a very, very light level of prophecy. A prophecy where like a thought just falls into your head. Doesn't mean all thoughts fall into your head of prophecy. But in the very, very light level, it can fall in. It is the lowest level of prophecy available. Okay, Derech HaChovah, we'll talk about this. In such a case, it is experienced like any other idea that arises spontaneously in one's mind. Let's eat. In a broader sense, this is also called divine inspiration or hidden influence. That's the lowest of the low, hidden influence. In the words of our sages, even though it is actually a much lower level, true divine inspiration, however, proper divine inspiration, is a very clear, I would add, an extremely vivid experience. If you read the Maharsha about it, it's extremely vivid. to the one worthy of it, and he is highly aware of the influence. So I just want to define a slang term. People often say, oh, he has Ruach HaKodesh. Oh, he has this level. Ruach HaKodesh, that is not what this... Okay, Ruach HaKodesh is such a potent experience that you won't really be able to experience anything else at that time. Often what people say is, you know, if you said something by Ruach HaKodesh, what they mean hidden influence. An individual could be on such a level that a hidden influence, which is extreme... Now, you can daven for this. On Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, in the art scroll Masorim, during the Kedusha prayer, there's a special prayer you can put in to actually ask for prophecy. But the prophecy you're asking for is hidden influence and Ruach HaKodesh. You can't ask for grand prophecy because it ain't available anymore. We'll talk about why not, what part of the organ in the brain was turned off, along with the Avodah Zarah, that meant that grand prophecy is no longer available to human consciousness. But there's a slang term that people use. You hear the term as Ruach HaKodesh. They don't mean full on Ruach HaKodesh. You probably don't even know what that means. What they mean is hidden influence.
So could you say that somebody like Newton or Einstein or any of these world-changing scientists or whatever, artists?
Not all world-changing concepts are hidden influence. That was just they were tapping into a particular thing that was available at that time. I can't know or say who got hidden influence and who didn't.
The example of that is one of his own chemistry was benzene green.
Yeah, he had a dream about a snake eating its own tail.
Yeah, exactly. He had a dream sneak his own tail, exactly.
Yeah, it's a benzene ring.
And suddenly saw that and he realised that was the chemical structure of the different things. And that just popped in his head. And that just...
No one can say. He can't even say with this influence because no one can know except for Hashem, right? But that doesn't mean any great discovery in the 20th century is all done by hidden influence.
It's either inspiration but could be influence.
That's correct. That's correct. We can't know, but that is the bottom level of prophetic channeling. That means the individual has to be conscious enough to tap into the lowest shard of that broadband. They simply aren't aware of it, but they actually are hitting a particularly inspired state. I have noticed personally that you could get into such a trance when improvising in music. If you get to a certain level of improvisation in music, you can literally just close your eyes and literally the fingers, everything just seems to play itself. You don't even know what's happening. You become like a channel for music. But even then, you don't know that's hidden influence, but it's almost like a meditative state. Okay? That doesn't mean it's going to be prophetically hidden influence. But you'd need to be in like a particularly inspired state of mind to be able to get any of this anyway.
I mean, there's some people who have inspirational thoughts about things which are way out of that time. Da Vinci or whatever.
Okay, Leonardo da Vinci invented the submarine and he invented the helicopter and the parachute and he was just a tremendous polymath, etc. You know, one of the greatest artists that ever lived. Yes, that doesn't mean he had an influence. He was extremely talented. He was blessed and cursed with great talent, right? There's a tremendous curse as well. Being ahead of your time is terrible. I mean, really, they thought it was bonkers, you know, inventing helicopters. He was right. He was right that, you know, that you can have a rotary ring that generates lift. But he was ahead of his time, which is a terrible curse. So, you know, that's a double-edged brocha. Let us continue. Ooh, okay, I'm just going to do one paragraph and then we're going to stop. There is another level, however, that is much higher than this hidden influence, than this divine inspiration. This is a level of true prophecy, what we really mean when we mean prophecy. This is a degree of inspiration where an individual reaches a level where he literally highlight or underline or make a note of, binds himself to God in such a way that he can actually feel this attachment. There are methods of doing this. You have to actually follow a prescribed method. There were schools, people enrolled in prophecy U. Okay, and we're going to talk about that. In fact, you have to. If you're going to do this, you will need a teacher to guide you through it, as we'll learn. He then clearly realises that the one to whom he's bound to is God, in a manner that will be discussed shortly. There is no way out of that. You will absolutely know, but you can't get there unless you're guided. Another reason why prophecy doesn't exist today is there's no arch prophets to teach anyone. The system has also been rigged with pitfalls, traps, in order to keep people away from it, which we'll talk about. There's actual special traps that have been set up to prevent an individual getting to this. This is sensed with complete clarity, with an awareness that leaves no room for any doubt whatsoever. The individual is as sure of it as he would be if it were a physical object observed with his physical senses. The main concept of true prophecy is therefore that a living person achieves such an attachment and bond with God. Highlight that, please. True prophecy is therefore a living person achieving such an attachment and bond with God. That is what prophecy is. Prophecy merely is a very high state of consciousness where you are actually understanding what really is. That's all prophecy is. Prophecy is a higher state of being. When you're in that state of being, it is more conducive sometimes to get transmissions of data. But getting that transmission of data is not a prerequisite to say, oh, I'm a prophet. Merely hitting that level is the level of prophecy. Finding lost objects, predicting the future, getting winning lottery numbers are all irrelevant. That does not mean it could be God says, listen, I want to tell you the winning lottery number for a reason, and he tells you through prophecy. But fuck a shot. Okay, then that was the prophecy. But that does not mean that's what prophecy is.